Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast. Been a while. A lot has been going on behind the scenes, and as you know, we've changed our format slightly for this season, going more to an ad hoc basis while we figure out what we want to do with the show. But I don't want listeners to fear, and I want to thank you all for your patience. It's been very, very busy behind the scenes and a lot going on with the future of the Palace Way, frankly. But we're still here trying to do our best to put content out on socials and really sort of deliver the sorts of content that you guys are used to seeing. But it's very, very good to be back on this pod. I have to say, I've kind of missed the hot seat of it all and very much going to take the back seat for this one and do a lot of the shutting up and let these lovely guys do a lot of the talking. So without further ado, I want to reintroduce some familiar faces back to the Palace Way. So we'll start with Pat. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. You know, it's June in Florida. The vacationers are gone. The spring breakers are gone. The snowbirds are gone. It's nothing but humidity and 90 degrees, 30 degrees centigrade temperatures until about September. This is where the true Floridians thrive. And what better way to battle the heat than talk about our FA Cup winning Crystal Palace Football Club. Happy to be back. Happy to be with you, boys.
I know, lots to talk about, honestly. And I'll welcome back another friend of the pod, Bobby Manzi of the New Shopper. How have you been?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Still basking in the glory of Crystal Palace's FA Cup win. I can't say as many nice things about Florida in June as Pat said, also about London in June as Pat said about Florida. I'm very good here. It's been super busy, actually. With England and the under-21s and Palace, and everything's just a bit hectic. Obviously, you've got the European stuff going on. There's a few transfers boiling away, but not much because it's hard to know what Palace can actually do when they don't know what level of competition they'll be playing in next season.
The more you guys introduce yourselves, the more I think, God, it's like a Pandora's box of stuff that's going on at the moment. I mean, it's absolute chaos. We're recording right as Forest owner has just actually written another Marinakis style hefty letter to UEFA. Funny seeing him in the spotlight, right? That's not like him. It's just chaos at the moment, really, as the club finds out whether we are or aren't in Europe. But before we look at the chaos, I want to bring back another familiar face to round off our three-man panel. Max, welcome back to the pod. How you been, mate?
Oh yeah, very, very good. Lapping up my Wembley trips that I reminisce of every single day, to be honest with you.
I was gonna say, did you go to both of them?
Yeah, I was at the semi and at the final. It was amazing. That after the semi, I was telling people that was the best day of my life. And then, well, the final happened, didn't it? And then that was it. It's just been incredible, really.
Yeah, the first time I got a semi, I told people it was the best day. Sorry. I had to say it. I don't know if I got that one.
Nice to know we're keeping it professional this evening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not in the mood to be professional. We've won the fucking FA Cup. Right, segue aside, I mean, the FA Cup is obviously going to form a cornerstone of what we talk about, whether it's the award ceremony that we'll get onto later, which I will go through in full like I did last season, or, you know, whether it's the general state of the club at the moment with the FA Cup and Europe. And, you know, there's so much to unpack here. So, I mean, we'll start with the cup because I think it's obviously the big feel-good story at the moment. We're kind of in a strange but privileged position here because we're recording, it's the 9th of June now, so it's getting on. I'm not quite there yet, but it's at least a good few weeks or so since the actual cup final. And, you know, by the time a month's settled, I still think there'll be this kind of air of optimism, regardless of what's going on with the Europa League. But, you know, we've spent genuinely years on this pod and even before this pod just clamouring for really two big things. One is to see Europe and the other is to win some kind of silverware. And it's quite surreal that I think we're in this strange position where we have both of those things. And as much as the joy is still ebbing and flowing through the veins of Palace fans all over the world, as I'm sure Pat in particular will attest to all the way over in Florida, let alone in South London, in Manchester, wherever we're all based today, you know, there's still this feeling that there's something bitter in the mouth after that. But let's not look at that. Let's look at just the cup win itself. I mean, Max, I'll bring you back in on this because you were there, as we were just discussing for both games. What was that like? Like, I know words probably don't do it justice, but just try to sum up the romanticism, the feeling, the sort of the tide of emotion that must have swept you away.
Well, like you said, it's so hard to do. But the feeling prior, I'd never thought that I was going to approach both the semi and the final with such optimism. And being at uni here, everyone seems to support a big six team. Like, my housemates are West Ham and Chelsea. So living with a Chelsea fan and a West Ham fan, both, you know, won European competitions and they've won trophies in recent years. I hear it all the time. And I had this relentless optimism that I know a lot of other people didn't actually share. But with the way that we just approached the cup in general, I just had this optimism the whole time. After the Villa game, it was absolutely amazing. The fact that just how we played, the pure domination throughout the whole 90 minutes, it was amazing. I left that, we were thinking, well, obviously at that point, we didn't know whether it was going to be Forest or City. I said I would have rather have had Forest, but it didn't even matter anyway. And the final, it was just amazing. There were so many key points throughout the day that like a highlights. I want to, like, definitely the Dino save was huge. The full time whistle. Luke was actually a couple of rows in front of me, and he was there was a lot of tears from him. There was a few from me, but I'd never been in one place where I'd seen so many grown men cry. It was honestly, it was amazing, full of emotion, and I just don't think it could have gone any better. Really, it was amazing, and I would just like to hope that we can experience something like that again.
I'm not going to take the limelight. I mean, that was beautiful, though. I think that sums it up perfectly. I mean, Bobby, I have to admit, I've not actually had the chance to ask you before this pod where you were, what, you know, whether you're in the stands, whether you're at home, whether you're in the press box. I mean, where were you? What did you do on the day? What? How did you feel? Let's just sort of sum it all up for me.
Yeah, it was just unbridled joy was probably the feeling. It's surreal. It still is surreal. I was in the press box at Wembley. Actually, let's go back to the start of the day. All week I'd been bricking it as a Palace fan. I've been very nervous. I was just didn't like the idea of playing City. I just wasn't up for it as such. Obviously up for the occasion, but I was fearing the game is probably the right way to put it. And Saturday morning I just woke up and I was convinced Palace were going to do it. And I was saying to everyone who was worried and nervous, who were texting me, my friends who are Palace fans, just enjoy it, because if you can't enjoy it now, we might not get the moment to enjoy it. So we can savour the build-up, and then when the game starts and when the game comes to an end, we'll have a feeling of either pure elation or devastation, but just enjoy the build-up. So I tried to immerse myself in the build-up, and that day, the start of that day was just unbelievable. Got to Wembley in the press box. And yeah, watched the game like a bag of nerves. I think all professionalism kind of went out of the window, to be brutally honest. We celebrated in the Wembley press box. It was just all of the Palace press kind of gathered in the middle. It was just a mental moment. And then I managed to get out of the press box into the stands, find my family and celebrate my family, which was a big moment for me personally, because my granddad was in hospital earlier this year after suffering a stroke, and for him to be at the game and being able to find him in the stands was just a real emotional moment for me. And it just kind of felt like it just felt like we'd done it. I think it's just the words that, like, everything in football was completed. Everything in life just felt perfect for that moment of time, and you will never be able to take that feeling away from someone. Yes, this whole UEFA saga might have soured the achievement, and UEFA will probably put one of the greatest triumphs in modern football history. They will shatter it if they do act in the way that they're talking. But no one can take the feelings away from every single Palace fan inside Wembley Stadium, watching at home, watching wherever they were that day.
Beautiful. And also, you talk about family in particular. That was something that stood out for me, Bobby. You know, I think it was a win, not just for the ones that are with us, but for the ones that never lived to see a day like that. And I think that's who I almost dedicated that win to in my own head. I hugged my dad in a pub full of United fans. I mean, you know, I live in Manchester. I bang on about it. I couldn't go because I was doing a half marathon the next day. So I had to be up in town. And I was very lucky in that my family did come up for it. And we just huddled around this TV, stacked in a corner in it. Like I said, a proper United pub, just bundle of nerves. But I think I remember sort of like the must have been like the 98th, 99th minute when Henderson just hoofed it from a goal kick, and you kind of knew we did it. I had my brother crying in the corner, my dad crying in the corner, thinking of his granddad and the ones that never made it. And then when that final whistle came, I'll never forget just seeing a Barry Eze in one corner of the screen just falling to his knees and praising God. And, you know, just that sudden realization that we'd done it and honoured so many Palace fans across generations, let alone those that are still at the heartbeat of our community. I mean, it's the best day in the club's history, and words can only do so much justice to it. But I think you guys have done an excellent job at that.
I'm totally with you. I think family was probably the most important part for me in the day. Just being in the press box and being away from the fans all season as a Palace fan, it's obviously tough. Sometimes there's days you really want to be in the Palace, and Wembley was one of those days. But I was in the press box, and but just being able to have that moment, my dad, my sister, my cousin, and my granddad, is just something I'll never forget. And it was 10 minutes, if that, in the Palace End, but it's probably 10 minutes that will mean more than anything for me for the rest of my life. I've used the word already, but it was just surreal. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it was how of this world. Honestly, we might not ever see a day like it for the next 100 years. Who knows? Pat, I want to give a special mention to you because I know it's obviously not a family thing, Palace, for you, but it means just as much to you. I think being an international fan, you've kind of completely opened my eyes, if I'm being honest, to a whole other way of seeing Palace. And I think completely changed my mind about what it means to be a Palace fan. And I see the dedication you put in and the time you put in, the silly hours you wake up for to watch this silly little club. And I just want to get your thoughts as well as to what you did on the day. What was your routine like? What were your emotions overall?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was too that my mind was with you all, that have the family, that have the generational connection, the people that were at the match and got to see it. My mind was, my heart was, everything was with you guys too, because I understand how important that is, because we do have American sports here that we go back generations with. I can go to a Syracuse University football game with my father, with my nephew. So my father, his son, his grandson. And eventually I'm going to hope to have that kind of relationship with Crystal Palace with my kids. It's just, I'm beginning in that struggle, beginning in that journey where you guys are kind of further down the road. So I really feel for that. As someone that comes from the professional sports world, I know how much sports mean. I know how much these moments mean. So it wasn't fully lost on me despite any of that. And we had a great crowd watching together, maybe like 25, 30 of us. I stood in one place when as they scored, and then I stayed in that place for the remainder of the match, including the penalty save. So my little sports superstition didn't leave me there from when I used to play. And yeah, I think it was just, I never was pessimistic about the performance, about the game, about what was going to happen. I never thought we were going to get, walked off the pitch. But I never felt optimistic either. It was almost this unreal feeling that we were there. It was, and just, I remember the sigh of relief at full time whistle and just the emotions kind of all hitting you at once and taking that deep breath and looking around and realizing it was real. It was something to be really prideful of, and something that really brought a lot of emotions out. And for someone like me that's remembers watching the first FA Cup final, for my experience against Man United, the Pardew dance, infamous scene with one other Palace fan, and now 9 years later being able to watch it with maybe 30 of them, and seeing that the work that not only myself but all of us here in this Tampa Bay area have put in to support this club, and kind of have that moment of fruition where it's paid off, not only on the pitch but also with the crowds of people we're getting, with the experiences, with the relationships that we're building locally. It all just kind of hit at once, and it was a very powerful moment for sure.
We might be separated by an ocean, but that feeling of community is what makes football football. And I think it's a really beautiful thing that you share in that. And yeah, it's really, really good to hear. We've all kind of touched upon the full-time whistle thing, but what exactly did you do at that specific time when the whistle went?
Think I did like a lap around the bar, just kind of walking and like staring out into space, and people were grabbing me and hugging me and stuff. But yeah, I don't really know. My mind was gone. I'll be honest with you. I wasn't making much sense as a normal human being, but it was just a moment of elation and a moment of just, realizing everything kind of hit at once.
Yeah. God, it's magical, this silly old game, isn't it? Right, unfortunately, we've got to digress and move on to the bit of the Debbie Downer of today. I mean, obviously, a lot of stuff going on in the press about whether Palace will actually get into Europe or not based on the ownership structure at the club and the ownership structure of Lyon in particular. There's concerns of Mr. John Textor. Bobby, you're the journalist. I'm not going to say token journalist, you're so much more than that, but I think it'd be remiss not to tweet to you about the facts. So what's exactly going on here with the ownership, and where do you think Palace stand on this with UEFA?
Yeah, I'll try to stick to the facts instead of what certain other pieces have done over the past couple of weeks. I actually think Sam Wallace did an excellent article on this, and he perfectly encapsulated the sense of bemusement in the Palace fan base at the moment. It's crucial to point out this is not straightforward. The precedent for this doesn't exist, really. Yes, there's Man City cases with Girona and the Red Bull cases, but they are very different. Any comparisons between the two are wide of the mark. So you just have to give it time. I think Palace feel that they've made a convincing argument to UEFA. I won't go over them again because I'm sure everyone who's listening to this and engages with the Palace discourse has read that in depth and has a full understanding of that now. It's key to point out that Palace maintain they are not in a multi-club model. Kingpin Steve Parish is vehemently against this. Palace have no involvement in a multi-club model whatsoever. There is just one individual who happens to own a stake in Palace, who is a majority owner of Lyon. I think ultimately it's down to UEFA and whether they decide they want to be overbearing sticklers for the rules. If they are, I think Palace are in some trouble for what is merely an administrative error. But I think it would be a grave injustice for something that really they haven't done much wrong. They'd be punishing club under multi-club ownership rules when they're not even in a multi-club system, whilst they let Man City and the Red Bull clubs and other clubs like that get away with it through loopholes, through putting things in blind trust, while clearly members of staff work across the two. I don't think it really needs saying that Jurgen Klopp is a director of football at two clubs who have played in the same competition. So I think it's quite clear that actually Palace are the ones who aren't doing anything wrong, who are abiding by the rules, but have one figure who stretches across two clubs. But actually, the way the ownership is set up at Palace doesn't have much power. Sam Wallace alluded to it in his piece. It's a thing I've heard a lot. John Textor has the most expensive season ticket in the Premier League. He doesn't do much. He doesn't have much power. Yes, he has told people that he was key in getting Oliver Glasner to the football club. And I do think that is true. But also, ultimately, the final decision lies with Steve Parish, as it has done at the football club. Steve Parish and the other two Americans massively outweigh John Textor in terms of decision-making processes. From my understanding, John Textor isn't involved in every board meeting. He is in some, but not every single one. So yeah, I think Palace would be delivered a huge injustice if they were kicked out of European football. And ultimately, as I alluded to earlier, it's an unbelievable triumph, Palace winning the FA Cup. It's just one of those stories that football can only deliver. They've beaten the elites, you know. Having to get past Fulham, Aston Villa, and Manchester City to win an FA Cup is no easy feat. And it's a story UEFA should be promoting rather than trying to kill.
100%. Bobby, I'll spare you any blushes and make you go on record as predicting anything. So I'll leave it to Pat and Max to sort of discuss, decide. Of course, if you want to at the end, Bobby, feel free to sort of chip in. But I'll
Oh,
start with
I
you.
will. I'll go straight away. I think it's
Yeah.
probably easier. There's no point trying to second guess. It's down to the UEFA judges now. Ultimately, it's down to their lawyers. There is no precedent, as I already mentioned, for a case like this. So it depends how well Palace have argued their case, and also how much they want to enforce the rules, and whether they do want to let them slide like they have other cases in the past. So it's really difficult to second guess what way they'll lean on this. I don't think the Nottingham Forest letter helps, but ultimately, it's a bit rich coming from them.
Yeah. Max, just what are your thoughts on this and what do you think comes out of this at the end of it?
Well, I said my piece on our group chat the other day about it, and up until probably only the last couple of days, again, I was quite optimistic. I thought football will always prevail, and that it would never actually get to the point where we're kicked out. And what I don't understand, Palace and Lyon can't play in the same European competition. So naturally, I'm not against the rule of the team that takes the Europa League spot is the team that finishes higher in their league. I understand in theory why that is an argument, but I do not think that. Could someone tell me where Lyon actually finished? Was it
Sixth.
eighth or
Sixth. They
sixth?
finished sixth.
It's crazy. They only sixth out against the odds because Strasbourg conceded a 99th minute goal on the final game, and PSG won the Coupe de France, the FA Cup equivalent. So the circumstances for both clubs even being in the Europa League at the same time is extraordinary when you actually think about the odds of that happening. Sorry, go on.
Exactly. And PSG did a clean sweep, right? Just as many would have predicted them to do. Okay. I do not think that you can compare Lyon finishing sixth in the top division of French football with Crystal Palace winning the oldest football competition in the world. I don't think they're really comparable. So to just give it to Lyon based on league position, I think is quite a lazy way of doing it.
It's a
But
cop out by UEFA, isn't it? For sure. Pat, I want to bring you in on this, but what are your thoughts on this overall?
I think Bobby put it as succinctly as possible that can they do it? They sure can. Will they do it? I'm an optimist. I'm going to say no. I don't think they will. There's a rule in baseball where it's called the, using inverted commas here, the neighborhood rule. And what it means is it protects the fielder from having to actually step on the base itself when making a play because they can roll their ankle, they can get hurt, they can hurt their knee, something might happen. So as long as they're, quote, in the neighborhood of the base, they don't have to actually step on the base and they can get the runner out. Could the umpire in that game, could the officials say, hey, you didn't step on the base, the player's safe? Absolutely, they could. They could do it every time if they wanted to. They just choose not to. And I just hope that UEFA has the integrity to choose not to enforce this because this is not what the rule was set up for. Can they do it? They absolutely can. And I don't want to speculate on, oh, if they say it, are we going to go to conference or is Bromby? I don't care about that stuff because I don't know if it's even going to come to that. And I don't want to speculate on it. But all I'll say is, yes, they absolutely have the right to not let us play. But I think it would be ridiculous if they did. And I hope they don't.
No,
I
exactly.
mean, Pat is bang on. You would be punishing a club for rules, which well, you would be giving a punishment for something the rules weren't set up for. The rules were set up to stop clubs like City doing 40 plus transfers with a partner club in one season. The rules were set up to stop football clubs giving games to their other clubs. For example, if Lyon and Palace were involved in a multi-club ownership and had to play each other in the eighth game of the league phase, both teams needed a point to qualify. That's what the rules are set up for, to stop things like that happening. But Palace, the reality is that Palace and Lyon aren't involved in a multi-club structure. They never have been. They never will be. You would, as Pat rightfully said, be punishing a club for something that the rules weren't set up for.
100%. Yeah, go on.
For God's sake, RB Leipzig and RB Salzburg share a name. They share a name and their badge is pretty much the same.
They played in
I
the
don't
same group. They played in the same group in Europa League in 2017, I think, or 18, same group.
how is that even in the same conversation as to what's going on here? It's ludicrous. I don't understand it. Well, yeah, we all know we
Ultimately, I think it comes down to the stature of the club.
Yeah.
And I think it's very easy to make an example without casting too many dispersion. I think it's very easy to make an example out of Crystal Palace, whereas Manchester City, Red Bull Leipzig, Red Bull Salzburg, maybe you're not going to have as much an easy time in court.
I do think, oh, from my view at least, I think there is that element of common sense prevailing, not to mention UEFA's own principle about advancing the sort of sporting, I forget the exact word they use, but there's something about the lines of not the sporting integrity, but actually the sporting stature of the game. So the spirit of this would go against that principle. I don't have the exact wording, but it is in UEFA's own statutes for sure. You can find it quite easily. I think it's even the second article under their own constitution, but it's certainly embedded in the philosophy of what UEFA wants to achieve with European football to allow these sorts of narratives to prevail, to, actually come together, look at the actual situation and move away from just the letter of the law towards something that I think is in the interest of football. You'd hope that would prevail. I think my only risk is that I think there is the chance that Palace essentially get used as an example, particularly as scrutiny over internal regulation of sport, at least in this country, is on the up. And I'm sure it's the same for Spain, particularly when you look at the financial situation there and the increased regulation there in sport. I think, there is a risk at European level that this is the prime time to sort of flex your muscles and say, look, we are doing our job here. So none of us were in those conversations. None of us know what will happen for sure. I'm very much with Pat in that I think, common sense will prevail with this, but we don't really know for sure, as Bobby also rightly says. Max, I can see you wanting to add something in. Go on.
Yeah, just before we move on from it, because I feel like we're approaching that point. What my biggest question, and maybe it's one that Bobby can answer. Why was this not brought up after the Villa game? When there was the potential, we were 90 minutes away from European football. It wasn't brought up then. It wasn't brought up the day after we won. Why? I don't understand why it's come out in the past, what, 10 days, 2 weeks or so. Why is it subject now when it wasn't brought up before?
I think we were all aware that it was probably a possibility this something like this could happen. The answer for the Villa game is quite simple. The deadline had already passed already. The deadline was March the 1st. Palace were, was that just before the Millwall game, just after the
Yeah,
Millwall game?
I think it was on the day even. I'll have to double check that, but it was around then, certainly.
So yeah, it's as simple as that. The deadline had already passed, so it wouldn't have made much difference. No point distracting the team with something like that before it happens.
Even then, the Lyon contingency as well, away from Palace, the Lyon contingency was very, very slim at that point as well. So the idea of both things aligning at once was a very distant prospect. It just
Exactly that. It
things
was
quite
March the
close.
1st as well, you're right.
Yeah. It just things just fell in a very particular way. Obviously, we come away with an FA Cup, and I think that is the headline. I think we can talk about Europe all we want, and I know we wanted it. Odds are, I think we get something, and even then, I think our day will come regardless. But no one, as we said at the start, can take away the FA Cup from us. I think the memories we have, the sense of community spirit it instilled in us, and the scenes we saw of that lovely trophy parade will never be forgotten for generations. And I think it's still not really dawned on us on this call and beyond that. We'll still be talking about, Jean-Philippe Mateta, Eberechi, Chris Richards, Dean Henderson. We'll be talking about these as that class of 25 for decades to come. I think that is something I think we don't really appreciate enough, the magnitude of that. Right, enough rambling from us. I think we need to move on to the main meat and drink of this show, which is the end of season awards. So without further ado, I'll run through the criteria and what we're going to cover today. So, looking at the awards we'll be going through tonight, I don't think there'll be any particular shocks for you guys, not least because I gave you the agenda before this little Zoom call that we're recording on. But pretty classic lineup, really. We'll start with Young Player of the Season, then we'll go on to Signing of the Season, Unsung Hero, which I think we're going to qualify broadly by 2,000 minutes or less, although I think I will allow some exceptions because I've heard a few good shouts already, Max. And we'll go from there. And then Game of the Season, and I'm banning the Cup. I'm banning Villa as well, actually. I'm going to ban those two games because I think they're pretty obvious contenders. I think there were also some very good games in the league to pick out, for example. And I think there's much more of an interesting conversation than just saying the FA Cup. Because let's be honest, the best game of the season was the FA Cup final, like, no question. Even if it wasn't the most fun game of football. So yeah, banning that. Moment of the season, again, FA Cup I think is too obvious, so I'm going to ban just lifting the cup, because we all know how brilliant that is. We spent about 20 minutes talking about it. And then lastly, the big one that is obviously a feature cornerstone of every single end of season awards, your player of the season. We'll then move on to some predictions at the end as well in terms of where we finish in the league and then the cups, potentially including the Europa League, and then a bit about transfers because we're starting to approach that sort of season. And then just a little wind up from there. So lots to unpack there, but let's just go back to the start. Young player of the season. I'm particularly thinking about either academy players or players that just broke into the first team and started to have those little cameos. I think Justin Devenny might be an easy one, but I'm not going to put words in anyone's mouth. So we'll use the same order that it appears on my screen, which is Max, Pat, and Bobby. So Max, we'll start with you, if that's all right. Who's your young player of the season and why?
Well, you've ruined my moment, Alex.
Damn
You've already said his name.
it.
Yeah, but honestly, I didn't really think this one was in much contention, in my view. If we're talking about a young player of the season being someone who, like you say, an academy graduate who just broke into that team, and I think Devenny ticks every box. Really, he came in at quite a crucial time, with the Eze injury, and we were in kind of that kind of period where we just the ball wouldn't seem to go in the net, and we just didn't really seem to be looking like the Palace we saw at the back end of season before. But I just feel like he filled the Eze hole quite well, considering. I know Bruno has spoken before about he never really thought that Devenny was going to have a long-term future at Palace, but from what you've done this season, really, who knows? I think his quality. I will say though, if we change it slightly and we said the young player of the season is an age, I think it goes to Wharton, despite him not playing as much as we would have liked. I still think his influence on the pitch is very much unmatched. But not to take anything away from Deveney, I think he ticks every box for this award.
No, he's spot on. I mean, I you know where I stand on that. I've just said it, but very much in agreement. I mean, even at Anfield, I was there on the final game watching him, and like Bruno said, even I was in the same camp. I never really paid much attention to the academy like Bruno did, but you never once thought Deveney was going to be someone that would ever really break out in the same way. He would just simply wasn't in that conversation. It looked like, you know, he was a bit older. He was sort of getting on a bit. He might get released and so on. And he's ended up just going from strength to strength. And like, I'll go back to Anfield. When he came on, even in that game, he just looked so comfortable. You know, really, really energetic in how he closed down balls, spraying good quality passing over good distances. You know, he looked comfortable, and that's the best compliment I can pay him. Okay, everyone's on the beach, blah, blah, blah. To rock up at Anfield and look very, very comfortable in that position was just a testament of what he's done doing all season. And, you know, to chip in with a big goal in the FA Cup run, and then to get that goal in Villa as well, which I think we'll all remember from that season. Maybe that's someone's moment of the season later. Then, you know, I think that just sort of sums up his strength to strength season that he's had. I use that word a lot, season. You're going to get annoyed of it. There's going to be a lot of seasoning tonight, but that is the nature of it. It's a bit of a look back. So I will shut up. Pat, I'll come over to you now. Who was your young player of the season?
Yeah, so I totally agree that if we're just going by age, it's clearly Adam Wharton. But I want to hold the integrity of this question for what it's meant to be. Hint, FIFA or UEFA, do the right thing with the Europa League. So I'm going to stay to the integrity of the question as it was designed. And I'm also going to agree, and I'm going to say Deveney. I think Chadi Riyad could have been a great shout if he stayed healthy. Shout out to my Betis people. It was great there, but we didn't really get to see what he could do. So maybe next year he could be in this category. Who knows? But Deveney, and I think you hit the nail on the head, Alex. He, the moment never looked too big for him. For me, watching a young player break through, that's more important than the statistics. That's more important than, you know, his positioning on the pitch. I think you can really see that kind of intangible moment of if they have the composure, if they're prepared for the moment, if it's not too big for them. And I think when you saw Deveney start for against Fulham earlier in the season for his first senior start, the moment wasn't too big for him at all. He fit in perfectly to that match, and whatever position they needed him to play, wherever they needed him on the pitch, he really seemed to jump in and give an effort and do a great job. I mean, I don't think his ceiling is as high as a lot of other of our younger players, but he definitely has that cult hero status where he can give you maybe a 7 out of 10 every time and just develop a lot of love and affection from the Palace support.
I mean, definitely let's assume we get some sort of Europe for safety's sake, we're going to need him. Like, the bottom line is we'll need him, we'll need SA, we'll need France some more. We just simply won't be able to not rotate in those situations. And, you know, his chapter at Palace is far from done. I think next season will be, this season was already his season, let's be honest, but I think next season he has the potential to go even higher and to really show what he's doing. And let's not talk about, by the way, that's not even talking about his Northern Ireland career as well, obviously making quite a few senior appearances for his country now. I believe he's been capped 3 times, but I'll have to check that, forcing a big error after latching on to a loose pass from Denmark to set up the opening goal for Northern Ireland in their 2-1 defeat to Denmark just a couple of days ago. All again down to the sort of the high pressing work rate that I think Glasner's philosophy has instilled in him. It's been a brilliant season for the young man. Bobby, do you want to mix it up? There's no shame if you just want to go to Deveney as well, by the way. I won't ever shoehorn you in, but I'd be interested to see if you've got anything else to say.
Yeah, I planned my answers and I'm going to have to echo what everybody else said, and it's going to be Justin Deveney for me. I think he massively stepped up. I think he showed a level that very few people expected from him. He's a good utility player. He's versatile. I think he's a very good player to have in the squad. And obviously he was handed a contract extension midway through the season this year, but he had only 1 year left on his deal. And normally when, you know, a player has 1 year left on the deal and the club give them an extra season, that's an indication that they're looking to sell that player this summer. And I actually think that probably was the plan, to sell Justin Deveney this summer after a okay season, some Premier League minutes, etc. But that's massively changed now. He's clawed himself into Oliver Glasner's plans for next season. He's versatile, he's a good player to have around the group, and you know, you can call him on for 20 minutes to play and trust him that he'll be able to see a game out. But he's not the greatest player on the planet. He misses maybe that little bit of cutting edge that you need from a player. He's not necessarily the quickest or the most athletic, but he will do a job for you. And I think that could be important going into Europe next season. I think he's done himself really proud next season. He's a smashing young lad too. I mean, we interviewed him after the win at Arsenal before the semi-final, and he just spoke brilliantly. And I think he should be really proud of himself this season. He's been superb. He's massively stepped up and just been brilliant for the football club. Oliver Glasner really likes him. He's really happy with him. And I just think he's done superb. You look back at the goal against Aston Villa, he took that well. The goal against Doncaster after missing a chance earlier that game, a couple of assists to his name as well.
He's been phenomenal. I mean, I don't know if he's got a long-term future at Palace, but certainly next season, and certainly more importantly at a higher level in football, he's definitely got a future. And I think above all, we can put his attributes aside, we can put his weaknesses aside. He's got the mentality. He's such a mature young man. He feels like a natural leader. I think he's so humble. I think he's someone who really takes to Glasner's tutelage and reaps the rewards ultimately. And you know, I'm
And
not gonna, go on.
that's a big part of it as well, because if you looked at the academy at the start of the season, Justin Devenny was probably the most ready player to step up because he's had that senior experience and his age, but he didn't by any means have the biggest ceiling. But what he has shown is coming into the team is what kind of everyone already knew about him, is that he is capable in senior football and he is going to go on to have a very, very good career, whether that be in the championship. But he will have another season at Palace. He'll get to play European football. And I mean, what an experience for that young man.
No, definitely. Look, I said I was going to go in the order of my screen, but I hope you don't mind, Bobby. I want to get people on the board at different points. I don't want people to get to the end all the time, Bobby, and have already taken your point. So I th if it's okay, Bobby, we'll then jump to back to you and right backwards. So Bobby, Pat, Max, Max, Pat, Bobby, if that makes sense. And I just want to get your thoughts on signing at the season. Obviously, a number of arrivals coming through the doors at SC25. I think a couple of names, in my view, probably stick out most, but I'm keen to hear who you'd vote for, Bobby.
So I think Ismaïla Sarr has a very good case, but I'm going to leave that because I actually have him down for a different award. So I'm going to say Maxence Lacroix, and I actually put him there because of the longevity of that signing. You signed as a 24-year-old for about £20 million. He's got a big ceiling, if you like. He's got good resale value to him, so there's room to make profit in the long term there. But crucially, it was just a huge upgrade on Anderson. He's a leader. He's great on the ball. His recovery pace gets the team out of so much trouble. He's probably saved more goals than anyone in the team this season, barring Dean Henderson. The group love him. He's just bought into the football club. He's a huge part of the culture. I mean, he describes himself as a bit of a pastor of the group. I know Jean-Philippe Mateta echoed that in his interview after the FA Cup final, and he's just a bit of a glue in that back line. I think he makes everything work. Playing in the centre of a back three is not an easy role. You require to be imposing, and you require a level of confidence. And he just oozes that confidence. And I think it's just an exceptional coup. And he's going to be a very big player going into European football. Obviously, he has experience playing in the German league. And I just think in all the big moments this season, Maxence Lacroix was there to step up, to lead the team, and just be a solid presence.
There's so much to be said for the culture at the club. I mean, there really, really is. And I think it's such a difficult thing to perfect in football, but we know, I mean, I hate to shout out this podcast because I hate Jake Humphrey, as I'm sure a lot of people do, but I listened to Glasner's interview he gave for the High Performance Podcast with Jake Humphrey, and it was phenomenal. I mean, there was such a good job on that podcast of just getting out his philosophy, his attitudes, his beliefs as a man and a manager. And I think Lacroix exemplifies that really, because his maturity, his leadership, his humility, I think, and his work rate, it epitomizes what Glasner wants from this group and what he's managed to get out of this group. So, you know, so much could be said for Lacroix. I think I mentioned it. He's born on the exact same day as me, which is
Oh,
also
wow.
a so I kind of have this soft spot for him based
He's
on.
much more level-headed than you, so clearly it
And
doesn't run in
taller,
like
by
the
the
dates and the star signs, as
way.
some people would have you believe.
There you go. Look, I can't argue with that. I haven't got the energy, Bobby. So thanks. But yeah, much to be said for my fellow areas. Anyway, right, jokes aside, Pat, I'm keen to get your thoughts as well. Signing of the season for you.
Signing of the season, American superstar Matt Turner. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm
You
kidding.
actually had me for
Kidding,
about a
I'm
second.
kidding, I'm kidding. Yeah.
You had me.
I am not that much of an American, guys. It's okay. All right, I feel like Sarr is another good answer, but again, like Bobby's saying, I'm gonna kind of pass it along, and I'm going to make the case for Daichi Kamada. Okay, so first of all, free signing. So yeah, a little higher on wages, but there was no transfer fee involved to look back and say, was the transfer fee worth it? And if you look, through our season from about, maybe late March, early April onward, he became a regular starter. He became trusted by Glasner, and he really didn't put a bad foot forward, including being linked together on the opening goal in the FA Cup final, which is something that's always going to be in Palace lore. And then showing up with a full suit and a pizza, I think that's pretty legendary too. So shout out to Daichi for that. I love the fashion sense on that, brother. But yeah, I think his determination, his commitment, his perseverance, he never let the bad press. I'm sure he heard the stuff that was said about him. He was performing bad too. I mean, even if you're trying to be objective and kind, you have to admit that. And he didn't let that affect him. He worked hard and he earned a spot and became one of the 11 starters in our first ever title winning match. So that's who I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with that.
And Daichi admitted he struggles this season himself. I think if you look at any interviews he did in Japanese and do a translate, I appreciate I'm getting really geeky now, but he's admitted that he had struggles this season. When I look back to that Villa game in the FA Cup semi-final, even the Villa away game actually as well in the Cup, I think there were two very, very good performances. And I think towards the end of the season, Pat makes a really good point that he stepped up when he was called upon. Maybe a bit bold to go signing of the season, but, I admire the creativity. And I think that last stretch of the season, 2, 3 months, whatever it was, I think he set an example, and hopefully you can carry that on into next season, take some momentum into that and be a crucial player when Palace hope to be playing European football.
Oh, for sure. Maybe it took him a while to adjust, but I think when you look at the most defining part of the season, he was one of the most defining players. And, I think that alone gives him some currency in that conversation, I have to be said. And a very difficult case to make, Pat, by the way, against the likes of Lacroix and Sarr. So I appreciate you giving it a very good go and making a convincing case there. So, Max, I think we kind of know who you're going to say now, but I mean, take it away. Is Maya Sarr?
Yeah, of course, it's Maya Sarr. I very much agreed with what Bobby said about Lacroix, and he really is the glue at the back. And I was also on the Kamada hate train for quite a long time. I feel like the majority of us was. But I just feel like Sarr, with the hole that Michael, the GOAT himself, with what the hole that Michael left in our team, whoever was going to come in was going to have an incredibly tough job, because of, when the hole is that big and it you lose without a doubt the best player that was in our team. And he didn't necessarily, I wouldn't say necessarily hit the ground running, but he scored some very important goals. I think he is very imperative to the way that we play. I'll touch on that a little bit later, but his directness and his pace. Me and my mate from Derby, who I go to the Palace games with, shout out to Billy. when we were on the train back from the semi final, and we watched the highlights about five times over. I think it was his third goal, the third goal, his second, the Nketiah pass. Konsa is only a couple of meters away from that ball, and oh my lord, I felt like I was watching prime Usain Bolt. It was unbelievable the way his acceleration, the way he just went, and then that was it. It was in the back of the net, and I feel like I saw something the other day about his. It was something like his goal chance creation with some. It was top five leagues. He was eighth, I think, in like all attackers of like chance creation. I'm going to bring Pat in because I know that Pat's going to have some crazy numbers on Sarr. So Pat, go on, take it away.
Hold on. I don't have any specific data on him on the front of him, but yeah, he was involved in some of the highest runs onto through balls. So essentially, through balls played onto him and Munoz out of anyone in the league, any attacker in the league. I don't have the exact number, but him playing behind defenses and him being able to stretch back lines not only created dangerous situations for us on the front foot, but also created a lot of space and opened up space in behind for not in behind the defense, but in that area kind of being vacated for Eze to get onto and be Eze and be creative. So yeah, Sar, great choice. I really appreciate him as a player and somebody that I admittedly wasn't really crazy on when we signed because probably like you said, he's not Elise, but I love him now. I very much saw the improvement and I think that he did great and took advantage of Glasner's coaching and really took our squad and our philosophy by storm.
So I was my pick too. I mean, let's not forget, this is the man who is essentially cast out by the wrong and signing shit haircut man Roberto Di Zerbi at Marseille, who had no pre-season, no time to get up to speed, was completely outcast. Came in basically along with a lot of that core, where they essentially had about 10 days together as an entire group. When you capture in the likes of Schalaber and Nketiah and others coming in too, you know, he had so little time to get up to speed, along with many other players, and I think the biggest compliment I can pay Sarr is to start from where he did, in and out the team, struggling for goals, to being someone as prolific as Elise, pretty much, and also being a huge part in that FA Cup run. I think it's something that will always etch him into Palace history. But I think the journey to get from A to B is phenomenal, and I think that for me is why he's my player of the season. Strategically, I think I like the angle that you take, Bobby, where you don't just think about him as the player he is and what he's contributed, but you think about the club rather than the man. And I think, again, Lacroix, a very worthy shout. I think they're all quite worthy shouts, and you put some very good
Do you
cases.
mean he's your signing of the season?
Signing of the season, sorry, yeah. Did I
Because
say
that's,
player
I don't, yeah, you said player of the season, and that's
Yes.
cut this bit, obviously, but the reason I've done it is because I've gone for Sarr as player of the season.
Yeah. Yeah, no, fine. I'll edit that out if it gets confused. No, cool. I'll stitch that up. But we must move on. Game of the season. Again, I'm gonna ban two games. I'm gonna ban the FA Cup final, obviously. I'm also gonna ban Villa in the semi. I think, again, for similar reasons, really. I think they're both monumental. They're both amazing occasions. I think, were it not for that banning, I think is a pretty natural shoe-in for that cup final. But I'd like to get your thoughts on that again. So, Bobby, I'll go back to you if that's okay. Mixing up the order again, apologies, but I'm quite keen to get your thoughts on game of the season.
Yeah, well, I'm actually still undecided, so I'll probably get there in this monologue. I jotted down a few that I thought were really fun games. Spurs away in the lead up to the FA Cup final, so finally win at Spurs was just a great feeling. Both Brighton games, the home game was just nuts. Two red cards, still found a way to win, and the away win was just emphatic. The 4-2 win at home over Wolves. A couple of days after the cup final, not for the game itself, obviously, but just the occasion of that was immense. So I think that has a really good shout as well. Villa at home just absolutely blew them away. One of the finest Palace performances of the season. And of course, the now customary win at Old Trafford, United away, winning 2-0 there was a very good day. Now, if I was going for the occasion, if I was giving it on the occasion, I would probably give it to the 4-2 win over Wolves just because of the atmosphere in Selhurst, the homecoming from winning the FA Cup. It just emphasised that the almost lunacy of Palace winning the FA Cup. It was just nuts. So if I was going for it on the occasion, I'd go the 4-2 win over Wolves. And now, but actually on the games themselves, I will probably say Brighton away. Trevor Chalobah, Ismaïla Sarr brace. I just thought Palace was so dominant that day when they'd had quite a few struggles in the season up to that point. And it was just, I think for me, it was the moment in the season that I thought Palace are back. Ismaïla Sarr just tore Brighton apart. Obviously, Palace had a difficult trip to the Amex the previous season. And it was just an acknowledgement that Crystal Palace are back. Oliver Glasner's incisive football is back. And Palace mean business for the rest of the season. I think that game set Palace on a really nice footing to go on and achieve what was eventually achieved in terms of the best ever league finish in the or the best ever points finish in the Premier League in the club's history, and that monumental win at Wembley.
Pat, it's quite a compelling case from Bobby. Do you agree? Do you have another game you'd like to pick out?
That game was fantastic, and I agree with everything he said. He touched on my pick a little bit. I'm going with the Villa match at home in the league. Just an utter dismantling of a very good Aston Villa side. It was the only time in this current Premier League run for Crystal Palace that they've scored four goals, had a goal difference of three, and had an XG difference of 3 as well or higher. So it's just an utter dismantling. I think we had close to 30 shots that game. You just really saw the tactical genius of Glasner combine with the physical preparation and just very hard-nosed kind of style that our players had. It was that time that both those things really clicked, where the players looked like they were in enough fitness to play the way he wanted them to play. And then he just showed that he can run rings around a really good manager in Unai Emery, because he had Emery going into a back four, going into a back five. I mean, he has wheel spinning. And to me, that was the most dominant performance that I've ever seen Palace have in league. And the numbers actually back that up too.
Yeah, very good.
And I think you make a good point, Pat, as well. And I think it's also important to remember that Palace had only won twice at home before that game. And to brush those worries aside that Palace can't buy a win at home, well, surely they can't kick up the table if they can't sort their home form up in that fashion. It was just phenomenal, and a testament to Oliver Glasner for staying true to his principles and also just keeping his faith in the group. I think I can't remember which player said it, but at some point during the season, I think it was even in the mix zone at Wembley after the FA Cup final, one of the players said that Oliver Glasner was really light on them when they were struggling in the league, and the better they got, the harsher he was. And that was when he upped his expectations, because he just let the players be and tried to figure them a way out. And then once he saw the levels from them, that's when he started to demand more, and that's when he started to be harsher when there were the few mistakes made. And I think that was quite telling, probably, as to how they got to that point and then kicked on for the rest of the season.
It sums them up well with Glasner being a very good man manager. I think that's one of the key things that makes him such a great manager, for the reasons you just said, Bobby.
I think he's only showed bad man management once this season, and that was with his handling of Romanesi at Anfield on the last day of the season. If you wanted my real word on that, I thought it was poor from Glasner. And I don't like to say that because I'm really fond of him, and I think he's an excellent man and manager. I think he's an excellent coach, and I think he's taken the football club to new heights. But I actually think, on reflection himself, that he probably acknowledges that he probably went a bit too far at Anfield. He said it just after the trophy parade that today is a good time to reflect on the season and not after the Anfield game. He was frustrated with the fact that Palace had got so many breaks, opportunities, and then not found a final pass. But I just think how he handled that situation, pulling a young Romanesi off to try and teach him a lesson, I thought it was probably wrong at the time. And then being so strong in his press conference afterwards on that, I do just think it was a little bit over the top is probably the right word to use.
And out of character, to be honest. So Max, I'll bring you back in.
My game of the season, been touched on before. For me, my three options were Brighton away for the reasons you've said, Villa at home for the reasons you've said. Just that was a key part of the season where we really showed our quality against the top side, because they were killing it in the Champions League at the time, and then we did that. But my game of the season is Brighton at home, because, well, it meant that we did a double over them for the first time in the league. I think that's huge in itself. I think it really showed the grit, the determination, and the overall teamwork, like of the team in general, to be able to grind out a result like that with all the red cards and everything that was going off. Joel Ward coming on to do his job. Don't worry, Bobby, I will mention it. Coming on to do his job and really hold it down for the last bit as well. It was an incredible game to watch. I really, really wish I could have been there to be that. I remember hearing Sellers Park on the TV and thinking, wow, that it must have been absolutely raw. And Bobby, I'm guessing you were there.
Yeah, I was there, mate. I think I only missed one home game this season, which was the 2-1 draw with Leicester. So I didn't miss much.
Would
But
you
yeah,
say that
I
was the loudest it had
go
been all season? Maybe
on. No, the Wolves game was,
apart
but
from
yeah,
Wolves.
other than that, it was the place was buzzing. Palace were phenomenal that day. As you said, they ground out a result. to secure that historic double over Brighton. I mean, Wardy coming on as a warrior when Palace was down to nine men was just my highlight of that, and managing to get the result and just make history. That they've made so much history this season, whether it's a small piece of history of securing a double over Brighton, whether it's, the points total, the FA Cup win, the big victories over the likes of Aston Villa. They've just had an absolutely phenomenal campaign. And I think the one thing I've probably taken away from the season is to not be so reactive. Because at the start of the season, when things weren't going so well, we were almost calling for Glazen's head at times, and we were a bit concerned of whether actually he was the man. And I mean, how naive was that to think? There was at times this season where we criticised Chris Richards, but when you think about it, it's because he hadn't had a run of games in the team, and the minute he had that, he turned into an exceptional defender. So I think the way this season's ended, and you look back at some of the things you might have criticised earlier this season, even the attitudes towards Daichi Kamada and how he finished the season. It just, I think it emphasizes that you just need to sometimes give things a bit of time. And actually, that Steve Parish deserves a lot of praise for that, because a lot of managers would have pulled the trigger on their manager when they were, 7 games into the season without a win. And he stayed true to him. He trusted what he had. He kept faith in Oliver Glasner. And my word, Oliver Glasner repaid that.
Good chat as always. Now, moving on. Let's talk about our unsung hero of the season. Preferably the less minutes the better, but there's no strict criteria, just not someone who's been mainstream, maybe someone who's been in and out of the team. Pat, let's go to you first. You're the furthest right on my screen. That's the scientific method I'm using for this. Who's your unsung hero?
It's a tough one. I don't know how unsung this is anymore because I think he's become a little bit of a very appreciative kind of fan favorite, but I'll go with my compatriot at this one, and I'm going to say Chris Richards. I think just him coming on when Chalobah left the club, when he went back to Chelsea, it changed the entire attacking shape that we had. It changed our organization. Chalobah was a great player, a decent player for us. I'm not going to sit here and badmouth him, but I think the style that Richards had when he came on really changed the way we moved forward and defended, and I think it made the world of difference for our results and our performances.
Let's talk about that FA Cup final performance, if nothing else. I mean, absolutely historic, monstrous at the back there, winning everything in the air, it seemed. I mean, that alone sums up the sort of renaissance he had in that second half, and a very, very worthy hero. Bobby, over to you. Who's your unsung hero? Do you agree? Do you disagree?
I disagree, but that's purely on technicality more than anything, because unsung hero is actually the one I struggled with the most, because I think by the end of the season we've actually celebrated the efforts of pretty much every single player in the squad. So I tried to think outside the box, and that led me to a bit of a different one in Nathaniel Clyne. I know he didn't have an abundance of minutes this season, but he was always available and ready to be called upon when he was needed. He missed the fewest training sessions of the entire squad, just one day the whole season, which unfortunately to him, for him, was just before the Liverpool game, which ruled him out, where he was expected to see some pretty decent minutes. But for his model professionalism, he's just always there to be called upon, and now he's happy to stay for another year when he probably could be playing minutes elsewhere, but he's there to give his services to Crystal Palace Football Club, a club he spent a long time in his career at across two separate spells. And I just think that's probably the definition of an unsung hero, if you like, because it's probably not spoken about much, but he's just always been there and been that model professional.
Let's not forget, he was brought in as a short-term stopgap while Nathan Ferguson was supposed to be recovering. And this is now, what, his sixth season? He's come back and been a phenomenal servant. And then, of course, an FA Cup winner to boot for the sort of boyhood club. I don't know if he was a boyhood fan necessarily, but certainly the club that brought him up into the footballing world, his local team. I mean, there's something to be said for that, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think ultimately that little bit of romance as well probably swayed my thinking there. And I just think he might not have had many minutes on the football pitch this season, probably fewer than 800. But just for his service to the football club, I think he's a worthy winner of the award.
100%, a very, very good case again. Max, I'll bring you in finally for your pick.
I'll keep it brief, but I know we spoke before about him being a player that was under 700, 800 minutes or whatever. But I'm going for Jefferson Lerma purely for the fact that I don't think he's not in our best 11 and hasn't really been in our best 11 for a while. But whenever he does step onto the pitch, it's 10 out of 10 every time. 10 out of 10 effort, at least. He runs his socks off. And it's just really quite refreshing to see a player who can take up and fill in those numerous roles whenever he's needed. Like when he drops into centre back, okay. Sometimes you might be able to tell that he's not the natural centre back in the three. But I feel like he always does a job and he does what he needs to do for the team. And I wanted to also mention Will Hughes, but I don't think Will Hughes is very unsung anymore, really. I think everyone knows all the Palace fans know about him. But yeah, I'm going for Lerma.
I think 3 years ago, Will Hughes would probably have been the correct answer, actually.
Yeah.
But as you rightfully say, he's no longer unsung. And I do think you raise a very good answer in Jefferson Lerma. He is being a, once again, just the effort he puts in doesn't go unnoticed for me anyway. And I think he's a superb defender. I actually think looking forward now where he's aged a bit, he's probably a better option as a centre back than he is a midfielder. And I think in Glasner's squad planning for the new season, they're kind of viewing him as centre back cover more than anything. So but maybe that says more what can be expected in the role from him next season when Palace are going into Europe. Maybe that understudy centre back who can also do a job in midfield when needed.
Definitely, much to be said there. And I think, regardless, I think he's still got a clear future at this club for the next few years. And, you know, we're all really delighted with the quality he's shown. I think three very, very diverse options and three very, very good cases. So I think, as always with these, I think the listeners' opinions will be the ones that we're keen to hear the most as well, because I think there's so many players that fit so many categories. And that's a testament to such a fine season that we've had as Palace fans and what we've been treated to. Before we look at the big one, I want to talk about moment of the season here. I specifically haven't given it much criteria for this for a reason, because I kind of want you guys to define what you'd really see as a moment. But I'm in my head thinking things like off the pitch moments, you know, particular characters around the club that have done good things either for the community, for the squad, for the club. I'm not thinking about the FA Cup win. Again, I'm going to ban that because I think it's too obvious, even though it is 100% the moment of the season in terms of lifting a trophy. I think there's just more interesting narratives than that. And I'm just quite keen to see what you guys did with that question. You know, maybe you were very orthodox and put it down to a goal of the season that you thought was particularly stunning. Maybe it's, you know, the contribution of a certain player. Maybe it's that time Jeff Schlupp got sent up to Celtic and won an FA Cup medal and the Scottish Premiership in the same season, just because it's just funny. But, you know, I want to see what you guys did with it. So, again, sorry to just sort of jump on the spot, but Pat, you're on the right for me, so I'm going to put you in first on this. What was your moment of the season?
So I did go with an on-the-pitch moment, but I chose it because of what the moment really represented more so than the actual goal itself or the points it gave us or anything like that. The end of November, we were 19th on the table with 8 points from our first 12. We played home against Newcastle and thoroughly outplayed them the entire match. They were winning 1-0 because of an own goal. And it was just one of those matches where it seemed like we were doing everything right. We had this you know, really strong club, an eventual cup winner, an eventual Champions League participant in Newcastle coming to Selhurst. And we thoroughly outplayed them. And we had nothing to show for it until a final stoppage time equalizer by Daniel Munoz. I think that moment was the moment where we started to believe maybe in Glasner again, or if we never stopped believing, it kind of reignited the reasons that we had such of an admiration for him to begin with. I think it was the moment that kind of united the fans with the club again and got us all pushing forward. And what happened in the three matches after that, we took 7 points in matches that included the arch rivals Brighton and also Manchester City. So it jump-started our season in a real sense, but I think really more importantly, it got us all together, united, going for the same cause and on our journey to eventual trophy-winning glory.
The absolute limbs, the great photos, the scenes off that goal were phenomenal. Funnily enough, that was my game of the season for the same reason. I think that was me trying to be edgy a bit and not go for a win, but because it was the catalyst for everything that followed, I think, in my view anyway. I won't discuss that or debate it. That's just me throwing that out there. But I'm glad, more importantly, that you raised that game, because I think it deserves a mention at some point on this pod. I think it was such an iconic moment in that season. And I think because it's, I don't know if it's recency bias or what, but I think because it's so far ahead in the start of the season in a particularly bad patch, I just don't think it gets the recognition. So thank you for that, Pat. Bobby, what was your moment of the season?
I don't know. I'm in a bit of a split about this because initially I was going to try and cheat it and say the FA Cup journey, not just winning the FA Cup, but the whole experience of that. And then I thought about the Muniz goal and Glasner running the length of the pitch and that kind of showing the camaraderie of the group. But I don't know. I quite enjoy Pastrygate. I thought that was quite funny. If anyone's unfamiliar, Oliver Glasner steals a pastry from the media table at the end of every press conference, and ahead of the FA Cup final, Oliver Glasner's quite a suspicious guy, and all the pastries had gone, so he got very angry after Palace had ensured there was one spare left for him, and it had disappeared by an unsuspecting cameraman at some point during the press conference. So that was quite amusing. I like the essence of the FA Cup photo being printed for the third round, and that staying in the dressing room throughout the competition to make it tangible that this is what Palace are playing for in every game. I quite like that story. But if you go into abstracts and necessarily you're not pinning it on one particular moment, but I just think my moment of the season is probably that togetherness of the group and just how bonded they are and how much of a force that was throughout the season. Ultimately, it's that bond that has brought the success. And I think if I try to be, you know, that little bit edgy and just think outside the box, I think whatever particular moment you pin it on, everything comes back to the spirit of the group and the spirit of the fans and the things that brought the fans together. I also think another couple of good moments are the two tifos at Wembley, which the Homesdale Fanatics did an excellent job with. First, with the little lad who was holding Andros Townsend's shirt, just in awe of it after Palace had won at Manchester City. Andros Townsend has scored a screamer, and just putting that there to show this is what a fan is for the players walking out onto the pitch in the semi-final, trying to make history for the football club and get that step closer. So I thought that was a very touching moment. And then for the final, I mean, I didn't think you could top the semi-final, but they really did. It just the most moving of stories and encapsulates what it means to be a football fan. We've touched on family earlier on today and what that win meant for me and what that win meant for everyone else. And I think those two boys who were unable to celebrate with their dad after winning the FA Cup, giving them that moment before the game and, you know, inducing them to tears and just echoing to everyone in the ground what this means for a club like Crystal Palace to go on and be a playing in another cup final and then eventually win it. I just think it was special doesn't even do it justice. It was just a it's been a truly remarkable season, and almost to pin one moment is really difficult. But I just think everything comes back to what it means to be Crystal Palace Football Club.
Sorry, I was on mute. That's such a classic. No, honestly, I think it's so hard to put into one moment, and I think you've dealt with that exploratory point, if I may say so, in a very good way. And you know, I don't think there's any shame. I know I said about the FA Cups. I meant about actually winning the trophy and what it means for history as being out of a cheat code. But I think actually to talk about the tifos, I think it goes back to your idea about the spirit of unity, because the unity isn't just what we've seen from this group of players that, again, as I've said, will be talked about for decades. It's more than that. You know, it's the unity across the club. It's with the board of directors, it's with the fans, most importantly. It's with Glasner, it's with the backroom staff, it's through even right down to the sponsors or the staff on the match days. I think there's this buzz around the club, this belief that we did it, and even before then, this belief that we could do it. And I think even above the cup itself, I think everyone was pulling in the same direction, whatever association you had with the club. And I think we've never seen such unity in the fan base for some time. We've had previous spats over Hodgson, over all sorts of issues that I think were defining in terms of where the direction of the club could go. But I think the destination was made all the more sweet by how everyone was brought together by it. And I think that's a really beautiful place to leave your sort of moment at
And
this.
even the wording of that tifo at Wembley, Wembley will shake and it will be beautiful. You know, that came from Maxence Lacroix, a player who we call our signing of the season. It just shows how brought in everyone is, every individual at the football club is, whether it's a member of staff, whether it's a player, whether it's a fan, just the cause that they were all working towards, it just all made sense that day. And so everything is always going to come back to the FA Cup win because it's the best day in the club's history. But it's those little moments, those little intricacies that just made it what it was. And that experience, it just, everyone has their own little connection to what happened that day, whether it was a truly personal moment, get to celebrate with your family, whether it was being on the tifo. And it's just remarkable.
It's phenomenal, wasn't it? Max, we need to bring you in here so we don't overrun, but I wanted to get your thoughts. Moment of the season.
Well, I've got a few personal ones, and then I've got, if we're banning the trophy lift, mine does involve a cup in some way. But personally, going to take my little brother to Sellers Park for the first time, was going down to London. That was probably my personal moment of the season. Unfortunately, it was Bournemouth 0-0. So, yeah, there was better games we could have gone to.
Classic, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you knew it was going to
How
happen.
scary. So we both said classic at the same time. That's remarkable.
Yeah.
Intuition. But also, I was at Doncaster when Franca came on for a little bit, and I will never forget when he ran the whole length of the pitch just to be able to touch the ball. That right in front of where I was sat, that was really good. Essay against Brentford, although what happened after might not have lived up to what we thought, but I don't know about you, but I was sat in the pub, and when he scored with his first touch, I thought, "Oh my Lord, who is this? Like, who have we brought in? This absolute gem." We'll leave that one there. But my actual moment of the season was the Dino save at Wembley, purely because I was right behind it. I was right behind it, lower tier, right next to the HF. I had some of the lads around me just turned around. They couldn't even watch, so they knew we saved it from our reactions around. And I think the it that was the moment that it started to feel okay. Maybe luck is on our side today. But yeah, the personal one, taking my brother to Sellers Park for the first time, is probably my moment of the season, really.
I think it's also worth mentioning, actually, I know we wanted to steer clear of the FA Cup win, but Joel lifting the FA Cup a couple of days after he just announced he left, was going to leave the football club at the end of the season. It felt like a real changing of the guard, and it just felt like a thank you to those who have gone before us as he lifted that trophy remark. This is the new generation now. He's the last player standing from that playoff squad, the last player standing from the squad that lost in the FA Cup final to Manchester United. And it was just a proper poignant moment. And it was just like, wow, everything that everyone has been working towards since Palace got promoted to the Premier League against Watford, it just made sense that day.
And the Swiss lawyers want to take it from us, right? That's another discussion I know that we already had. But, it just sums up what football's all about on a more positive note about the narrative. And, it was a brilliant way to send him off. I think, his speech, his leaving speech was phenomenal. He only really gave some remarks. I think even a speech is probably a stretch. But, immediately after that cup, I think he used the words that, our ceiling is your floor, referring to that intergenerational change. And I think that sums it up really in terms of where we find ourselves as a club, that there really is the next level, to use an infamous quote, that stands before us now. And I think we finally realize that it's an
Well,
exciting time for the football club. Go on, go on.
we interviewed him the day before, 2 days before the Liverpool game on that Friday. And obviously, Joel Ward, you kind of know what you're getting when you interview Joel Ward. He says pretty similar things all the time. And he'd done a lot of media work in that week about his final week at the club. So we kind of expected him to say the same things he did before. So we went a bit of a different angle of it and, spoke to him about the fans and. There was an anecdote that a fan had had dinner with him the day he actually signed for the football club, totally out of the blue, and we were playing these stories to him, and there was also a fan who had been testing out this new partially sighted equipment to understand the game better when they're in the stadium with the VR. So we spoke to him about all of this stuff, about how the day felt for those people, and he got really emotional, and it was like. He everything almost come on top of him then, especially when he was talking about his kids as well. He made a really nice story actually about he was trying to explain to his little one that it's not the end of Crystal Palace, but it's just the end of Daddy's time at Crystal Palace, was his quote. Because his kid was so small that it just wasn't quite grasping that. Because his whole life has been Joel Ward at Crystal Palace or Dad at Crystal Palace, and now it's gone. He was kind of thinking that's the end of that chapter, but he vowed that he's got, you know, kids who will be Crystal Palace fans for the rest of their lives. And he's just a truly remarkable man. And it was lovely to see. And I think him getting that moment at Wembley, that brilliant farewell, and then having one more start in a Palace shirt as that final hurrah, it was just a great moment. And I think actually that's probably the feel-good story everyone wants from this season, beside winning the FA Cup. And I would say that's a very worthy moment of the season.
100%. The Ward sends off the sort of the Wembley, everything about it. I mean, lifting the cup is obviously huge, but I think when you think about the legacy of Joel Ward, I mean, words can barely do it justice, as we've said for so many things on this pod today. But what a servant, what a club legend. I mean, is he up there with Wilf? He's at the very least a rung down, and that's being harsh, frankly, it feels. He's such an integral part for where we have been and where we are that, you know, he would always be in the hearts of fans far and wide. So all the best to him. I have no idea what comes next for Joel Ward, but I think what you get out of that, Bobby, and it's a fantastic story, so thank you for that, is just that understanding of what football means for fans and what he can do for fans, what joy he can bring into people's lives, even in a small way. And I think that sums up what football's all about. So thank you very much for sharing that. Big, big one now. And unlike others, I'd like to get some consensus on this. We awarded for contacts Jefferson Lerma this last season, and I have a very strong suspicion he won't win it this year, not for any fault of his own, but through sheer brilliance of so many contenders. This is, of course, Player of the Season. Now, apologies, I did use Signing of the Season and Player of the Season interchangeably in that last bit. I want to make clear that obviously this is a much wider context and definition. It's for any Player of the Season. You could give it to Matt Turner if you really want to be a prick, but no one's going to do that. So Pat's buzzing. Pat's absolutely buzzing. Chris Richards could actually be a contender. I'm not saying there's not a case for him though. So if you want to shoehorn him in, go for it. But seriously, actually, I think this is a good time, Pat, to jump in on there. Who is your Player of the Season? I think there's so many ways you could frame that, and I think this is more of the general big hitter. Who do you think out of so many contenders deserves that honor?
Yeah, and that is a great thing, a great dilemma to have is a lot of players being deserving of this. So I'm going to echo the club, and I'm going to say it's Daniel Munoz. They're out of all fullbacks and wingbacks included in the whoever played in those positions in the Premier League this season. Munoz is third in goal involvements, both goals and assists, tied with Trent Alexander-Arnold in that. If you look at expected goals and expected assisted goals, so essentially you're looking at the quality of chances that you either are creating for someone else or that you are trying to put on goal yourself. He was number one amongst wingbacks in the Premier League for that. Left or right did not matter. His 11 or his 10.5 was considerably higher than second place at 9.2. So he was an animal offensively. And if you look at those numbers, you think, well, he must be kind of one of those luxury attacking wingbacks who barely goes back and plays defense. No, he was one of the most active defensive players from that position as well. So a true two-way player, almost like a box-to-box midfielder playing on the right flank. His ability to get behind, freed up space inside. I mean, look at those cutbacks in the FA Cup runs, the Eze against Villa, against City. You saw that plenty of matches, plenty of times throughout the year. And somebody that really embodies the spirit of Crystal Palace, I think, as well. He was a socio, what they would call an ultra or a fanatic in his native Colombia for his local team. So he was on the, you know, in the crowd, lighting the pyros, waving the flags. He understands what this sport means, and you can see he wears it. He wears that heart on his sleeve anytime he goes out on the pitch. So in terms of his attitude, in terms of his performance, I think it's Munoz. I think the club got it right.
100%. I think he was the fans' favourite and the club's favourite. No question that he's a very, very worthy contender. I think I'm sat here thinking there's about seven people I could name at least that could be in a shout for that. You know, I'm not gonna name all of them, but I'm thinking Munoz, you know, Mateta, Henderson, Eze, even Richards. Maybe there's so many players at Wharton. I mean, you could genuinely go on and make a case for all of these. So it's a competitive one. I think it'd be interesting to see whether we all go for a Colombian double on this pod. This is our second ever. TPW award ceremony. Bobby, I'll bring you in. Who's your pick for player of the season? You're welcome to agree, by the way. I'm not going to punish you for not being disagreeable. I'd be good to have some consensus on this one, but I'm very much open to anyone on this. Who do you think is your player of the season?
Well, Daniel Munoz was the club's favourite. He was the fans' favourite. He was Pat's favourite, but he wasn't my favourite. Ismaila Sarr is my player of the season. A 20 goal. I'll explain why he wasn't my signing of the season first, rather than and I've just given him player of the season. I just think when I look at the bigger picture of the signing of the season and the whole long-term strategy of the club, Sarr is kind of just outside of that, I think, with the age bracket. I think he's almost now a player that will finish his career at Palace, all being well, and if he carries on this trajectory. So he kind of, when I look at a player, sorry, a signing of the season, he doesn't really fit into that model of number one being exceptional, but number two having the ability to having a huge ceiling. I think we're now seeing a peak version of Ismaila Sarr. But so yeah, giving him player of the season, I 20 goal contributions in terms of goals and assists this season. Just undeniably important to the football club. He's been invaluable, his contributions this season. Michael Olyseo left the football club and it was a big hole to fill. And by no means he's got that same quality as Michael Olyseo, but he offered Palace something different this term. And he stepped up in big moments. You saw the best version of Ismaila Sarr against the higher lines when he could hang off that last man and run in behind. I think, you look back to Brighton away, as I alluded to earlier on in the podcast, those two goals were just exquisite. The cup semi-final just murdered Aston Villa with his runs in behind. The goals show that. He has just been a revelation in a Palace shirt this season, going from having no pre-season, being an exile at Marseille, to then coming to Palace and just setting the world alight. He's quite a shy character, if you notice. I think, you look at him sitting on the pitch at Wembley and just taking everything all in away from the group, being slightly lost in ticker tape. And, I just think he's been superb and words can't do it justice, really. He's a player that Dougie Freeman has been on the tower for a hell of a long time and he's always just fallen short. But this season explained why Palace have tried for him for so long. He has just been, he's been irreplaceable in a Palace shirt for me this season. His contributions, his attacking influence, but also, and this probably gets lost a little bit, his application defensively. He works so hard, a bit like Daniel Munoz, up and down that flank, does not stop, chases the ball down, always helping the team out defensively. And I just think his contributions in a Palace shirt have just stood tall above everyone. And I understand the case for Daniel Munoz because he is non-stop. He has been the man in so many occasions this season. The goals he's provided, the defensive excellence he's exhibited, when actually that's been a part of the game people have criticised of him in the past. I still think he's been solid defensively. And in the cup final from Daniel Munoz, my word, he was probably so tired by the end of that game. But no one was going to beat him flying into tackles in the penalty box. That ball was pinging around, yet all of a sudden he just managed to pick it up. So it was really tight for me, and you're almost splitting feathers in the end. But just for Sarr and just for the impact he's had, I ended up going with him.
I'm going to reserve judgment. I know who my pick is as well, by the way. I'm going to see if I could be a kingmaker at the end, because it'd be nice if we could have a definitive podcast one. If not, we will give this out to the listeners, but that will be revealed, I guess, on air as we record, obviously. Max, you're next to Bobby on my screen, so I'm going to bring you in. Who is your player of the season?
So for this one, I really wanted to give it to Eze for all the obvious reasons. I've been quite pessimistic about Eze, especially on this pod. I remember like my first couple of episodes when I remember I used the term, he would often think it was the Eze show at times. And I remember being at Leicester away. And every time he got the ball, I just thought he just slowed the game down. But then when it mattered, he really, really stepped up. But I'm not going to give it to Eze though. I'm also going to agree with Pat. I'm giving it to Munoz because I have never seen a right back in in my lifetime and the footballers that I've seen, I've not seen a right back be so good in each third of the pitch. It's we often talk we he'll obviously always be compared to Mitchell for obvious reasons. And Mitchell, as much as Pat likes to throw us the numbers about him, his output in the attacking third, he very, in my eyes, Mitchell's main strengths are in that defensive third, right? Munoz, I think his quality in every single one. I couldn't really say if his attacking output is better than his defending. You've just got to enjoy him as a player and everything that he does. He is so imperative to the way that we play. And I think if you take Munoz out of our team, Glasner Ball doesn't work. I don't think Crystal Palace can play the way that we have seen that we can play over the past 18 months or so, without him being there. He just has completely transformed the team. He's just crucial. I can't say too much without repeating what Pat said, but he honestly, he's probably my favorite Palace player because he not only has the quality, but he also shows his love for the club as well.
I mean, an excellent assessment. You're spot on. I don't want to add because there's been so much that's already been said about both these players, actually. And what I will say is, I found it funny that in the days putting up to recording this, I was quite certain it was Ismaïla Sarr, and I kept thinking about it. And Sarr he's been brilliant. He might not have scored the most goals in this Palace squad, but he certainly scored some of the most important, barring the goal in the final itself. I think he came up in huge moments, secured vital points, and obviously was the star of the show in the semi that got us to that final. But I mean, Daniel Munoz for me just has to narrowly edge it. I think let's just be complimentary first. I think it's so telling that we're talking about these two who play on the exact same side, who show very, very similar qualities. I think without either of them, there's no Glasner Ball. I think that right side has been devastating. I think the left and right are both strong, but they operate very different ways in an offensive sense in terms of what attributes come out on them. And if we move away from the tactical and more towards the spiritual, I've never seen someone who lives and breathes football and I think, as Pat said, understands what it is to play for your club. Now, this might not be Atletic Nacional in Colombia, but this is certainly a team that lives and breathes football right from the fan base down to the pitch. And whichever way you splice it, I think he plays with a Palace shirt as though it was his own. And that's the highest compliment I can pay him. His energy, his work rate, his physicality, his. I don't want to say violence, that was the word that came to mind, but you know what I mean? The sort of positive aggression that we see from him is someone who fights and dies for the shirt. I mean, Joel Ward is never going to be a Daniel Munoz figure. They're both brilliant in their own right, but I think for this new era of Palace and in terms of handing over that torch, which has been a theme, I think there's the perfect way to do it there between an older generation of right back that suited a different time for Palace and a new right back that suits a new era for Palace. Will it stay that way forever? Who knows? But I think for the reasons everyone else has put so well, I think for me, Daniel Munoz has sort of swayed me and edged it. So I think it is a Colombian double from this pod overall. It's going to be Jefferson Lerma in the previous season, and then for 24-25, Daniel Munoz take a bow. I hope we sign another Colombian now so we can see if they can have a similar impact this time next year. But listen, Bobby, I know we were going to talk about, and I know you discussed about this in the interim about some awards at the end, some predictions at the end. Actually, I'm going to redo that. But I said at the start we would look at some predictions at the end, but I think in the interest of time, we'll wrap it up. We are going to be back at some point with more episodes looking at predictions for next season, the transfer window, and more. And I think by combining those two themes, I think we'll probably have a much larger episode to talk about. Again, Bruno and I will be releasing a separate episode just talking a bit about the Palace way at the meta level. Even the guys on the call today, thank you very much for your time. We haven't been keeping you in the loop like we should, and we know that. So Bruno and I are working in the background to essentially figure out a new direction for the Palace way, and there is a lot already that's been done on that that we don't know, and then more stuff that we're still working through. So we'll release that to everyone in terms of listeners as well as you guys in due course. But on a more positive note, just it's been a long night of recording and there's been so much to say. Did we go on a bit? Not at all, because I think everything that was said summed up and did some justice to what has been the best season in Crystal Palace history. And I think to even be commenting on a small part of that is an extreme privilege. So it's just been a pleasure doing it tonight with you guys. So thank you, boys. Bobby, any final thoughts from you, mate?
No final thoughts. No, I think I've spoken enough this evening. I've probably repeated myself a dozen times with my limited active vocabulary. So yeah, I think I'm all spoken out. It's just keep enjoying the FA Cup win is all I would say. Enjoy it while you can. Try and forget about the European shenanigans. You can't affect them. It's all going to be decided behind closed doors now, and when everything happens, that will be communicated. But just try not to worry. Try not to read too much into everything that's published. And stay true to your convictions, and you know, if something does happen to Palace, make sure you call out the injustice, and if it doesn't, then obviously it's the right decision.
No, of course. And, you know, at the end of the day, as we've said before, no one can take away the feelings we've just laid out there. No one can take away the memories, the strife that we've gone through as a fan base, and the payoff when we got the moment that we've been clamouring for that we never thought would come in many ways. So, you know, spot on, it's out of our control. Let's just enjoy what we have and worry about the future when it comes to it. But I will just say I've got a deposit on a Airbnb in Bologna that I am keeping an eye on. Anyway, Max, thank you for coming on again and sharing your thoughts as always. Any closing thoughts?
No, other than just shadowing what Bobby said, we need to keep the optimism and think about the FA Cup win and not about what's going on with UEFA at the minute. It was, yeah, like you say, the greatest Crystal Palace season ever in many regards. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this UEFA shenanigans to be over with soon so that we can start looking at some transfer news. I think that's going to be exciting over the summer. But yeah, just very much looking forward to next season now.
No, 100%. I think Europe or not, there's always going to be something big to play for with this group. And there's this real belief that even with perhaps the likes of Eze and Gueye going and so on, as we'll discuss in the next episode and about speculation with transfers, you know, the core of this group would always remain. Hopefully, Glasner will remain too. It looks like Thomas Frank, by the way, is ending any links to Spurs quite quickly now, as that looks like that's got legs. So, you know, we'll save all this for the next episode. But my point is, I think this Palace we've grown to know and love, and the Palace we've seen this season and just spoke at length talking about, isn't really going anywhere at its core. And I think that only bodes well for the future. So, thank you again, Max. And then Pat, lastly, I know it's been very difficult for both you and me to get on and record, but it's good to have you back finally. And I'm just glad we were able to have this conversation, to be honest. And more importantly, just great to hear from you again. So, as always, thank you for your excellent insight and your great takes. And I'm really glad to have heard your stories as well about how you celebrated the cup. So, yeah, any closing thoughts from you, mate?
Yeah, glad to be back. And depending on when we record the next episode, I'll be able to tell you about my FA or FIFA Club World Cup experience in true me sicko mode. I'm going to see Ulsan from South Korea play Mamelodi Sundowns from South Africa. And I'll let you guys know if I get to any one-on-one FaceTime, maybe get an autograph from Ulsan player Lee Chung-Yong.
There we go, blast from the past. That is dedication to Palace. Give him my
Yeah,
best if you see him.
man. Why not? No
Dedicated to the
question.
cause.
That is unbelievable. I didn't know that. Well, thanks for revealing that at the end. That's pretty cool. Is that taking place in Florida?
It's in Orlando, so it's going to be about maybe 1 hour and 15 minutes away. And but my wife's got something to do in Orlando anyway, so hey.
Oh, that works out. Nice one. Right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, everyone, for your time again. Just one last thank you from me. And of course, thank you to the listeners for your ongoing patience and support. I know it's been less than fun not having the regular Palace Way podcast straight to your Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcast, but we are in the process of future-proofing and planning for TBW. We will probably discuss this in more detail in a separate update episode, but from my side, I want to just confirm that, and I know I did this last season, but I want to announce that I am stepping down completely from TPW, not just the podcast. Been a long time coming. I don't think anyone that you guys on the call here won't be surprised either, but this is something that I've been having to think about for a long time now. I'm not going to dramatize it. I just don't have the time, the hobbies, the energy to do it anymore. I won't go into detail about why, but I'm buying off a lot of hobbies. I'm in the process of looking at buying a flat. There's loads of stuff that is just taking up far too much of my time. Is it an excuse? Yes, because ultimately I do love this project, but if I wanted to do it, I would. I would find the time from somewhere. And I think at a higher level than whatever's going on in my life, I'm just knackered and I don't have the motivation like I used to. And that might not be the most sexy reason to step down, but it's the truth. I think, you know, unlike this is going to sound really football-y and dramatic, but I really think I've done my bit to take this pod as far as it can go. I was messaged by an annoying kid called Bruno, who's still an annoying kid now, of course, but someone who's done a lot for this podcast and this project, who I genuinely admire, jokes aside. He's so entrepreneurial at a good age and is going to go so far in life. And I'll always be grateful for getting a message years ago off him just saying, hey, look, I've got this project I'm starting and someone referred me to you saying that, you know, you've done some stuff on Instagram and we thought you'd be a good fit for it. I don't want to spend lots of time reflecting on my time at the Palace Way, but I see behind the scenes the amount of people we've had that have been involved. Obviously, Bobby cut his teeth managing our editorial team there, and it's been great to see his career flourish. It's been great to see project at large take on new platforms and go as far as it has done. But really, I think, as I say, I've taken it as far as it can go, and I think it's only fair that a whole new roster of people behind the scenes and indeed in front of the podcast microphones maybe take this project forward. I can't say for sure right now about everything that will happen in the future, but what I can say is that I hope that the likes of Bobby, Pat and Max will be still around and still very much able to come back on the pod as guests, but we are in the process of succession planning and hopefully being able to deliver the consistency that this platform deserves. Ultimately, there's 50,000 plus followers across socials, and I don't say that as a numbers game. I don't really care about followers. I care about engagement, and we're still by far the most engaged Crystal Palace platform there is, and we're immensely proud of that fact. Our lines on this really about that message, you know, we started this podcast to appeal to a newer, younger generation of fans who maybe didn't idolise the Jim Cannons of this world, and we thought that was okay. You know, we don't really see fans old or young as being that different, and we accept that different icons of different generations are inevitable, but the digital landscape has changed and we felt so too should there be a Palace platform that speaks to that. And that's what we delivered. We wanted to deliver a brand that spoke to that younger generation of fan, and indeed any generation of fan at heart, but one that targeted the users on Instagram, TikTok, the podcasting platforms as an extension of that, the website. You know, we wanted to give young journalists a voice. There was such a rejuvenating spirit we wanted to bring to Palace discourse. And we've not always got it right, but we've definitely tried to stay true to that principle. And I leave with my head held high, believing that we have. Listen, I'll end it there. I won't do my usual full outro, but obviously please check us out on socials at The Palace Way on X/Twitter and in Instagram as well. And you can obviously find our website at thepalaceway.com, which we intend to do more in the future, but obviously you can still find our archive of articles, analysis, news and more of our own Joel Wardle and so on. And of course, please give this podcast a review. This is not the end of The Palace Way podcast. In fact, I would posit this is only the beginning. And I'm really excited that you guys stick around for that journey. So not one last time, because I may be doing pods in the interim over the summer while we work on that plan, but it's still been an absolute privilege to be a very, very small voice in a much bigger Palace community, much bigger than myself or indeed any of us, at the exact time that we enjoy the greatest season in Crystal Palace history. It doesn't just honour me, as we said earlier on the pod, it honours those that came before us and indeed a little bit of those that will come in the future too, but it's a great time to be a Palace fan and indeed a great time to be engaged in all things Palace. So we will continue to do our best and what we can to keep in that spirit, to engage, to re-engage, to look to the future together, and ultimately to create that positive discourse, to create new things for this community, because it's what we're all about. We're just fans at the end of the day, and we've left the bloody FA Cup. What could be more exciting than that? And it's been an absolute privilege to be a part of that. I will stop rambling on. Stay safe. Enjoy the celebrations, and as we say, don't worry about the what-ifs. This is our moment. This is us as Palace fans. This is the new future and era we find ourselves in. Thank you very much, and up the Palace.